You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday, we take 30 minutes of your time to talk about taste, something that we don't always spend enough time talking about, I think, and I hope that you think so too. And thank you for joining us for that conversation. Today, we're very excited to have with us in the studio Michael Romano, who you may know as the chef of Union Square Cafe, I should say, but has many hats. He's a James Beard Award-winning chef, best chef in New York, of the Outstanding Restaurant of the Year Award, which was the Union Square Cafe, and a member of the Who's Who. And there are so many things we've already been talking about that we're going to continue to talk about, but ostensibly we're here to talk about a new book that he has written, obviously representing the group of restaurants, the Union Square Hospitality Group, and that is The Family Table. Thank you for being with us here in Bushwick, Michael.
You're very welcome. Great to be here, Mitchell. Thank you.
I want to talk about, there's so many things I want to talk about with you, as I said, and who knows where we're going to get to, but this idea, this beautiful book that you've written, co-authored, I guess, on with Karen Stabiner. Yeah, and there's a foreword by Danny Meyer, of course, because in some ways he's the vision behind all of the wonderful things that you've had a hand in producing for the Union Square Hospitality Group. I want to talk about the family meal, this concept of the family meal, which I think sometimes we throw around people who are in the food business as though everyone knows what we're talking about. Mm. And it's a funny thing to say, really, when you're talking about employees, feeding employees, basically, is what we're talking about. Tell us a little bit about the phenomenon of the family meal.
I've realized what you just said, being on book tour with this book, that people don't know necessarily about how this works in a restaurant. The people who work in the restaurant have to eat as well, and it's kind of different from office workers who bring in your lunch or you go out and get something.
Because you're surrounded by food all day long, right?
So for me, it first came into my, I first became aware of it back in France in the 70s, working in different places. We would all stop before lunch and sit down. The chefs, often the chefs would sit apart from the dining room staff and have a meal.
What do they call it there? Is it called La Famille?
Yes. I remember. I do recall it being referred to as
family meal,
La Famille.
Basically.
Yeah. So, okay. So when I came to Union Square Cafe, I made it a point of insisting, in a sense, that people sit down and enjoy. The cooks often are resistant to that. Oh, I don't have enough time, and I'll just grab something while I'm working. And I would say no. You know, don't do that. Take the, even if it's 10 minutes, even if it's 15 minutes, sit down and enjoy some food, eat, and then get back. Because you think you're gaining time by eating, wolfing down something while you're working, but actually you're doing neither very well.
Right.
So just stop. And there's an ulterior motive behind this. The main reasons are, one, you need to nourish your body, right? Mm-hmm. So you're working long shifts. Everyone knows restaurant work is challenging. It's you need to eat so that you're nourished, but also so that you're not walking around hungry and looking at the food that you're bringing out to the guests.
Licking your lips, right? Oh, boy, that looks good here, right?
Thinking, I want to have some of that. Because you know what's going to happen is people are going to start to pick around the food, and then everybody gets in trouble. The health department doesn't like that. The chef doesn't like that. So better you have a nice meal and you're all set. The second thing is emotionally, if you're fed and you're well fed, you feel taken care of, right? Uh-huh. And if you feel taken care of, then you are more inclined to take care of those who will be fed by the restaurant.
Interesting.
it just creates this wonderful synergy and this wonderful virtuous circle of, uh-huh. of you feel contented and proud of the place where you work, and you're able to transfer that to the guest. And also it creates community among the people sitting down, having uh-huh. the meal together. They take a break. They're not working, not talking about work, just connecting with each other and in a very casual way, and enjoying the food. So it achieves a number of things, which is why it's very important.
So, first of all, when did you come to Union Square Cafe? Let's get some details.
88.
88.
The restaurant opened in 85.
Okay.
That's 1985.
Right.
And I was at La Caravelle from uh-huh. 1984 to 1988, where we also sat down, not only ate, but drank.
Okay.
In the French tradition, some of the old right. Those guys were great. I love the old guard guys would have they'd set up an aperitif before the lunch every day. This was every day, an aperitif before the lunch, then wine with the lunch, then a little coffee with a little cognac would manage to get into the coffee cup, and it was astounding. I could never keep up with that kind of
okay.
and then go back to work. But anyway, we didn't do that at Union Square Cafe. So when I got there, we all sat down and in the same room, the waiters and kitchen tended to sit by them, their own group, but at least we were in the same room.
So let's talk about the logistics a little bit. When do these meals happen? I mean, obviously you're serving lunch
right.
at lunchtime and dinner at dinner time.
Right.
When do you serve the staff?
So twice a day. If lunch starts at 12, we'll sit down at 11, let's say, so that we have a half an hour break and then time for the dining room to be reset, the waiters to the servers to freshen up and get ready. So about 11, and then around 4:30 in the afternoon, 4:35, depends on the place, before the dinner. So it's an early meal. I like eating early.
Uh-huh.
So it's an early meal, and then sometimes there'll be something late at night after the evening shift, just because it's been a long shift and people are hungry. Uh-huh. And
how many, so let's take one of the restaurants, Union Square Cafe, how many people are being fed at one of these?
Oh, it's probably around 30 or so, 30 or 40.
So that's some serious food.
Yeah, yeah. At our catering Union Square events, it has grown sometimes there's 70 people.
At Family Meal.
Yes, it's amazing.
Okay, so
Gramercy Tavern also has a large group.
Right. Wow. So what are the who is making dinner? Let's start there.
Good question. So the chefs are not making the meal.
Okay.
The executive chefs, which is why in the book we have contributions from the chefs, including myself, but we ask them to bring in things that they make for their family or have made for them.
So not the restaurant dishes.
It's
not
the
menu items, right?
So it's the line cooks, and each chef will have a different system in place. Sometimes it's a rotating basis. The line cooks, so okay, you're doing veg, you're doing protein, you're doing starch, and the cook has to come up with some food, and they have a limited time,
right.
and a limited range of things they can use. You don't want to see truffles going out to the
right.
dining room first.
But presumably, you're ordering special food to feed 30 or 40 or 70 people
yes.
twice a day.
Usually, it's a combination.
It's not the
no.
butts of lettuce or I don't know things that.
Well, it is, but it's a combination.
Okay.
Most often, you'll have some things that are ordered in specifically. Others are well, we've got this, this wonderful food left over. So we use that, and the cooks get creative and come up with, which was one of the fun and most interesting challenges of this book, was these did not exist as recipes.
Right.
They were just a cook
making dinner,
throwing together
right.
something, and he or she would say, I put about a cup of that in. Really, it was a tablespoon.
Right.
So we had to, and Karen sort of sussed out the basic bones of the dish, and then I had to turn it into a recipe and test it and make sure it worked.
Well,
so that was the biggest challenge.
And so you mentioned the idea that coming together for this meal, I mean, the commensality of the experience builds community in the restaurant. I imagine doing a book also. There
yeah.
are profiles here of people you don't always right. see profiles about in the restaurant, and yet they're integral parts of the team. There would be no
right.
restaurant without the prep cooks or without the garde-manger or all the people doing all the other stuff. So talk about that process
Very
and
true.
How that impacted maybe what the restaurant community?
Well, we noticed, you know, many of these people have been with us for a long time, mm-hmm. and people assume these sort of archetypal roles in the restaurant. There's the, you know, the mama we talk about, Carolyn,
right.
at the Union Square. These are people who, because of their longevity and the intensity of their commitment to the restaurant, carry the sort of the oral history of what is this restaurant about. And that's incredibly important when new people come in. Mm-hmm. There's someone to turn to who will guide you and say, okay, this is the way we do it, this is the way we don't do it. And it's being initiated into a group. Mm-hmm. So when you have that kind of tradition carried on, that becomes a very rich part of the restaurant's history, of its life. So we wanted to celebrate that and have some of these stories and talk about the people who work day to day. And what happened is the people became very proud, both of the recipes that got included and their stories, and it created a wonderful effect across the restaurants. Uh-huh. And now I go into the restaurants and people are like, oh, I love that story, or thanks right. for putting my recipe in. And cool. You know, they're very proud of it. Yeah.
I'm curious, because of this is what our show's about whether or not part of that community building has some taste implications, because you're working, restaurant kitchens are made up of people from all different ethnicities, oftentimes unfamiliar, at least at the beginning, with the cuisines being served by the restaurant itself. Right. And I'm wondering if there's any cohesion of flavor exchange or taste memory or something that happens around the family table in these restaurants.
Well, we certainly do have a rich ethnic variety in the book.
For sure. It's
which
really
is, you know,
appetizing.
Things you're not going to find on the menu at any of the restaurants, Gramercy Tavern or whatever. You have a lot of Latin American dishes and Korean dishes. And so, of course, people cook from what they know and what they love, and they want to share that with their co-workers. So it was a great opportunity to bring in a lot of different ethnicities.
Has anything ever found its way from Family Meal onto yes. the menu? Not in a dish,
yes.
even if a spice mix. I don't know. Just curious.
No, it has. One of my favorite dishes in the entire book is the Dominican beef.
Uh-huh.
Victor Estrella at Union Square Cafe was making it. And the current chef, Carmen Qualiata, put it on the brunch menu.
Oh, funny.
Because it's such a great, it really is right. a great dish. It's so simple. It's so delicious, and every time I happen to be by there and I see that, I'm so happy, and I just grab a big plate of it. But
and I guess the follow-up question is, has anyone's hidden culinary talent been discovered in preparation of Family Meal, or is it sort of a known thing before they're even asked to do it?
That I'm not sure. I do know for a fact that you can sort of suss out who is really committed, who is really dedicated to being a cook by what he or she cooks for Family Meal. Because if you know, food is food, and if you are telling me, let's say I'm the chef, and you say to me, I really want to grow in this company and I want to be a great cook, but your Family Meal is terrible, well then how does that, you know, it doesn't work.
Right,
If you care about food, you care about it all the time, and you do your best.
Proud
to make,
serve it also,
exactly,
I imagine, to stand
exactly.
behind it.
Right.
I want to remind people listening that if you have questions for Michael about Family Meal, about this beautiful new book, or some of the things we're going to talk about, which you don't know yet, but you will, you can call us at 718-497-2128. You can also write us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or you can tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. Those last two, the email and the Twitter feed, are true also if you're just listening to the podcast or downloading the archive from heritageradionetwork.org. So as I flip through the book, and it's something I would encourage you to do, because as Michael said, there are so many different recipes from all over, and it just seems like yummy food you want to eat. I'm wondering, in a restaurant, have you had experience in a restaurant that doesn't do this? That sort of widens the gap between the staff and the diners? And what happens in that situation?
Yeah, I've seen it happen where the meal is not served. Okay, so people are sort of on their own, fending for themselves, grabbing whatever they can, and sort of standing off in a corner and you know, scarfing it down, and it creates a kind of feeling of the opposite of, well,
right.
they don't care about
obvious,
me,
right.
you know, so I have to fend for myself and grab what I can. And some places will do a system where you can order from a limited group of dishes from the menu, which is, I guess it's okay, but it doesn't create that moment of we're all sitting down, excuse me, we're all sitting down and choosing what we're going to eat and enjoying it together. It's this
and that
separation.
Together piece is what's so key, and it's obviously right. What you hear about the environment that you and Danny Meyer have created in all of your restaurants, the sense across the restaurants that there's a community there, that these aren't just right. actors showing up on their way to something else or mm-hmm. you know, even if they are.
If they are, we'd yeah. like them to be very committed to,
right,
what, they're
to
doing,
what they're doing.
You know, and you, it's hard to ask for that kind of commitment if you don't give that commitment first.
Right.
That's the thing.
Right.
You don't, you know, one of the things I really dislike when I go to a restaurant and the waiter, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, will actually badmouth the management.
Not an experience you want, right?
Right. Part of. You know, they say, ah, oh, they. It makes you feel very uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
It's like, I think I need to leave now.
In fact, I just recently had an experience where we were overhearing, there was an open kitchen and we were overhearing the chef berate some of the staff. And even though we were loving the meal we were eating, it ruined our meal. Just to hear that happen was not appetizing.
And I'd say it's a good thing. It's a relatively new thing. I mean, I grew up in this business working in France for many years, and you know, the French are wonderful and they're super talented at this, but there is that atmosphere of it's tough. Mm-hmm. It's tough. And it could get physical, it could get violent, it could get mm-hmm. really, and it was always, and this incredible animosity between the dining room and the kitchen staff.
Right.
I never understood why that was. And so when you create that kind of an atmosphere, I believe it's really hard to give genuine, caring attention to your guests. Mm. Because as you just experienced, you pick up on that, and it mars the experience for me, you know.
Right. That's why here at Heritage Radio Network, they are so nice to us. Yeah. And we're going to be right back. We'll take a brief break. And I think we're going to change topics and talk about some, maybe Japan, I hope, with Michael Romano from the Union Square Hospitality Group, author of Family Table. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
You are listening to Lung by Itgi Dean. More to come here on Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with Michael Romano, who is a partner and director of culinary development at the Union Square Hospitality Group, famous as the chef of Union Square Cafe, although you can taste his hands in the food at all of the wonderful restaurants of that hospitality group, Gramercy Tavern and Untitled. And it's funny because it's such a collection of great restaurants and great chefs and great service. Really iconic New York things. In fact, we were just talking, we're speaking just after the Big Apple Barbecue, which is something mm-hmm. that group created and has become this annual Porkapalooza.
Yeah.
130,000 people come to Madison Square for barbecue mm-hmm. in New York City, which is also crazy and improbable and half the mm-hmm. fun. But I'd like to talk to you a little bit about one of your other passions, which is Japan and Japanese culture.
Thanks for listening.
Whoops. And that is, well, Japan, as I said, because partly because I'm getting ready to go there, and partly because you have a Union Square cafe in Tokyo.
Yes, Union Square, Tokyo.
Yeah. And I want to start just by asking, what, from a food perspective, obviously there are so many cultural things about Japan, but what is it? Can you describe a little bit about what you see there, what you admire about the food culture of Japan? I know that's a huge question, but you know, what do you take away when you come back from there about food that informs you or inspires you?
Well, I guess first and foremost is the passion people have around food. Mm-hmm. I guess when you have a culture that is so homogenous as the Japanese. People have what I like to call a rich gastronomic heritage. They know their food. They know they're very familiar with the dishes and also are very proud of their cuisine. So when you have a situation like that, coupled with the Japanese ability to really, really hone in and focus on developing a skill, mm-hmm. you know, spending an entire lifetime. You hear the stories about young sushi chefs spending 5 years learning how to wash the rice before you.
Right.
And it's these are true stories. And there's that single-minded dedication that is probably the only way to achieve the heights that they do in terms of their food. And you see these exquisite kaiseki meals. So that really, I find really wonderful. Mm-hmm. And also the very sort of casual day-to-day food
right.
that it's just so delicious, and it's for me right now. It's the way I like to eat. It's not so filling. They don't use very much fat. Of course, not eating a lot of bread and things like that. So I find you can eat a lot and not feel full or bloated.
Do they have a tradition in restaurants of family meal? Just out of curiosity?
Yes. The term is makanai.
Okay.
And at our Union Square Tokyo, I love watching. In fact, there's a recipe in the book for the fried chicken that they do there occasionally. In our restaurant at around, I guess the lunch service starts winding down around 2:30, 3:00. And it's an interesting process. Little by little, as each cook, for example, will finish his or her work, they'll start to put up a dish, and there's a pass counter where the servers pick up the food to bring to the guests, and that slowly will start filling up as the service starts waning. That starts filling up with dishes,
like the buffet for
yes,
dinner?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. They just right. start putting up dishes, and there'll always be a kind of a broth, and there'll be like the, you know, the Japanese love that curry, uh-huh. so they put the curry up, and there'll be something fried, and there'll be. Some leftover, even raw fish that's right. that's done for that day, and by the time 3:30, 4:00 rolls around, the entire counter is filled with dishes.
Right.
And what I've noticed is I can't wait. I just dive
sure.
in and grab a plate and go sit in the dining room or somewhere. But the cooks the dining room staff tends to serve themselves first. And then the cooks will clean up and get ready and then grab. And there's always a fresh pot of rice. And so, yes, they do. I don't know. I would imagine that this holds true for most Japanese restaurants, although
sure.
I have not had that experience.
I do recall in Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which we were talking about earlier, there is a scene where they're all sitting around eating. They're
right.
preparing their own sushi for dinner.
You know, right.
It looks pretty tasty,
yeah.
even that, en masse. I'm wondering, part of what... Union Square Cafe really helped define was this incredibly comfortable, friendly, solicitous service, I would say, in a positive sense. Just, you know, it's all about you, the customer. And I'm wondering if that translated at all to Japan, which seems, as you said, there's an understanding of how to behave and how to want, and obviously it's the group, not the individual. Was there
yes.
anything about that?
Well... It's an interesting question because there's such a deep tradition of incredible hospitality in Japan.
Of course.
Often it feels a little bit by rote And there are certain set things that one says when, let's say, a guest enters a store and when a guest leaves a store. And we tried to, seeing that and try to capitalize on that wonderful sense of hospitality. And as I think Danny once said, trying to teach them a little jazz, in other words, improvise, loosen up a bit, and tailor the situation to each guest a little bit more than is usually done. And I think it's working. I think that they are really getting that and really embracing that. And one of the things I love about the folks over there, at our team at Union Square Tokyo, is they really do embrace the Union Square Hospitality Group ideas and philosophies. And there was an amazing story that just makes me laugh every time I think about it. Danny had just visited the restaurant. He's been a few times and spoken to everyone. And they take it very seriously and really enjoy his talks. And so he was gone, and I'm working at the restaurant, and one day I passed by the private dining room, and there was a meeting going on with the dining room staff, and they're all standing in a circle, right, looking at each other with their hands over their mouths, their hands covering their mouths. And I had the same reaction. Oh, this is some kind of secret cult thing or something. And so later on, I just observed, and then later on I asked the maitre d', who's this wonderful fellow, I said, what was that about? And he said, oh, we were just trying to put into practice what Danny told us about learning to smile with our eyes.
Oh, so covering their mouths so you can see. Oh, my God, how great is that?
You know, and it's trying so
to perfect
wonderful.
It, right? to
and
master.
They'll do things that we might think is a little bit corny, a little bit, but they just embrace it so wholeheartedly that it endears them to me so much. It's just wonderful. What a great idea.
totally. So what are you looking forward to? I mean, I know you're actually on your way back to Japan. You go there two or three times a year in a good year. But what food-wise, restaurant-wise, I mean, is there anything in the works? This book obviously was a tremendous effort of the whole staff, clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still sort of coming off of the, you know, the tour.
The afterglow,
The afterglow of the book, and hoping it does well. And you know, when you write a book like that, you spend so much time focusing on what could possibly not be right. Right with it,
right,
and then you release it, and you think, "Oh God, it's I don't know." And then it's wonderful when you get positive reinforcement.
Sure,
it's just great. But after that, I'm you know back to going to Tokyo, but also in New York, spending a lot of time with our catering company, Union Square Events, spending time with a new business we've created, Creative Juice. That we, you know, I created a line of cold press juices and smoothies that we were in collaboration with Equinox Gyms.
Oh, really? Wow.
That is ramping up. When I left Tokyo this last trip, we had 2 stores, and now I think we have 6.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and with many more on the horizon. So, working closely with our the chef who's running that.
And obviously health and vitality is behind Creative Juice, or what's the
since it's a gym oriented and a lot of these sort of cleanses are spinning out from that, and I had a lot of fun developing the juices. I think they're good. I think they're interesting, using foods that ingredients that I didn't see being used in other
such
applications. Radicchio, fennel, lemongrass, kefir lime. What else? Dried fruits.
That's cool.
Yeah, different fun things. Fresh chamomile.
And these are in-store experiences. We're not yet in the, I don't know, the Whole Foods.
Not yet, no.
Fresh
we're still
section,
in the,
right.
just in the Equinox.
Wow.
So I'll get back into that and try to keep the juices seasonal, so there's some new ones I hope to come up with for the summer.
So Union Square Cafe opened in 1985 and remains an iconic restaurant, which is no small feat. I mean, that's practically legendary status in our business. How do you keep it fresh there? I mean, by sort of stimulating yourself in these other projects. I know, obviously, you have a great team there.
It's all about them.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, now, you know, Sam Lipp, the general manager and partner, and Carmen Quagliata, chef and partner, it's them. You know, they are... To be able to, for all of us, Danny and my partner Paul Bowles-Bevan and myself, to step back and bring in people with fresh, you know, younger people with fresh ideas, and let them do it. Let them, you know, if you get into this mindset of, well, it's an icon and we can't change it, and let's just fossilize it and keep it, you're surely headed for trouble. But so they bring in new ideas, and they've had so many changes, and Carmen is such a great chef. And the wonderful thing is that he's a great chef, but he gets Union Square Cafe, and he has taken it further and great places, and he's just such a great cook, so that that's how you keep a place alive.
Right, right. You know? Well, that's
It's not. I can't. It's not me in there day to day anymore.
Of course.
So we're very grateful for that. It has to be something alive and breathing and developing.
And I have to say, as a New Yorker, we are very grateful for that. It's one of those Union Square Cafe and the Union Square Hospitality Group, as I've already said, it's one of those things that just makes people feel good when you say it. People remember their experiences at Union Square Cafe and tears well up in their eyes. Yeah. They felt so well cared for.
See, that's the thing. It's how you make people feel. That's what they remember.
Yeah.
That's what they remember.
Well, thank you for being with us. You've made us feel very special by here coming here to chat about family meals in Japan and all sorts of things in between. Next week, we will be chatting with Dave Arnold, who many of you may know as the host of Cooking Issues here on Heritage Radio Network. He's also the owner and, I guess, master mixologist of Booker and Dax, affiliated with the International Culinary Center. And we get your questions ready because he can answer anything, whether or not he knows the information. Thank you for listening. In the meantime, think about family meal. Think about thinking of your own meal at home as family meal, which it seems backwards and ironic. But of course, that same idea of community and sharing and pride in what you cook, is it comes from that sense of sitting around the table at home before it's anywhere. So
exactly,
do that. And thanks, Michael, for being here.
Thank you, Mitchell. Great to be here.
This is Taste Matters.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.